You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you are joining us from. My name is Scott Worden, and I am the Director of Afghanistan and Central Asia Programs for the U.S. Institute of Peace. We're thrilled to be co-hosting today's event with U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide. This event calls attention to the current atrocity risks facing vulnerable groups in Afghanistan and discusses how the threats may evolve over time and what are the immediate as well as long-term actions the U.S. and the international community can take to prevent further violence. The prospect of mass atrocities should be its own highest motivator for action, but often appears to be insufficient. With that in mind, I would note that the Afghan conflict over the last 50 years, starting with the communist coup in 1978 and the Soviet invasion that followed, has been marked by atrocities on all sides of the conflict that have been executed with impunity. Atrocities committed in one conflict beget more atrocities in future conflicts, and they perpetuate a cycle of violence that not only consumes its victims, but causes international instability and creates havens for terrorism that threaten our own security. Prevention is therefore not only a moral act or a humanitarian act, but it is a national security act. And it should be pursued with vigor for all of these reasons in Afghanistan, but also numerous high-risk countries around the world. Every conflict and context for mass atrocities is different, but the swift response to atrocities in Ukraine presents something of a model for galvanized action that we should keep in mind when we look with alarm at the repression and persecution that is occurring in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan today. There are things the international community can do, and we can act quickly and decisively when we have the will. This panel discussion will highlight the need for action and what steps can be taken to reduce the risk of mass atrocities in Afghanistan. We'll begin with a keynote remark by Rena Miri, the U.S. Special Envoy for Afghan Women, Girls, and Human Rights. Previously, she served as a senior advisor to the U.S. Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan during the Obama administration, and she's been a senior U.N. official with the United Nations Assistance Mission for Afghanistan and the U.N.'s Mediation Support Unit. Then, Naomi Kikoler will moderate a discussion with an outstanding panel of experts, both on Afghanistan and on atrocity prevention. Naomi is the director of the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide and has led the center's policy engagement with the United States government and their work, and has also worked on bearing witness countries, including undertaking documentation of the commission of genocide by ISIS. She's also worked for the UN Office of the Special Advisor on the Prevention of Genocide and the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. USIP was founded 35 years ago as an independent, nonpartisan national institute with the goal of preventing, mitigating, and resolving violent conflict. We've been working in Afghanistan and on Afghanistan since 2002, including on issues of transitional justice and protecting women's rights, which is active today. We also support U.S. government efforts to prevent and respond to mass atrocities, including co-chairing the 2009 Genocide Prevention Task Force, which has provided the broad framework for U.S. atrocity prevention and response, and training. And we have trained U.S. government staff on atrocity prevention. For this event, we invite all of you to take part in the discussion by asking a question using the chat box function on the events page. We ask that you include your name and specify where you are joining us from. We'll select several questions from amongst these that we receive for the second part of our discussion to pose to the panelists. Finally, you can engage with us and with each other on Twitter throughout the event using today's hashtag, #AfghanistanUSIP. And with that, we will now turn to Rena Amiri's keynote remarks.
I'd like to begin by thanking USIP and the Holocaust Memorial Museum for convening this critical and timely discussion focused on the situation of Hazaras, religious minorities, and other vulnerable populations in Afghanistan. The people of Afghanistan are confronting a myriad of crises simultaneously. Since the assumption of power by the de facto Taliban authorities, the country has plunged into an economic meltdown, leaving 97% of the population vulnerable to hunger and food insecurity. Much of the population has been stripped of their legal rights that they had so valiantly struggled for. Those that bear the brunt of this hardship are the most vulnerable, women and children, and ethnic and religious minorities. The world has at least acknowledged the desperate situation of women and girls who have been rendered invisible overnight and stripped of their basic rights. It is far from adequate, but the injustice is at least part of international deliberations on Afghanistan. The situation of ethnic and religious minority communities has received far less attention. Hazaras, Hindus and Sikhs, Ismailis, Panjshiris, Ahmadis, among others, feel under acute threat. My office, in cooperation with Representative Tom West's office, the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor, USAID, and other parts of the government, regularly consult with representatives from these communities. What we hear is a range of abuses, from seizures of their properties to the raiding of their homes and offices, to unequal distribution of humanitarian aid, detentions, disappearances, physical abuse and torture. The Hazara population in particular speak of the existential fears they and their families face. A group that has faced historical injustice and inequity in Afghanistan, they are currently under even greater threat. As one young woman said to me, as a visible other, I don't have the option of lowering my profile to escape harm. These communities feel under threat, both from the Taliban that have historically singled them out, and Daesh, ISIS-K, that has unleashed a campaign of targeted attacks against the community. The Hazara activists and leaders I speak to do not feel safe in their homes, in mosques, in medical clinics, and their communities. They don't feel safe when their sisters or wives are in labor, or when their children are in school. All of these places have become the target of brutal attacks, some claimed by ISIS-K, killing newborn infants, school children, innocent men and women. No one has been held to account. No perpetrators have been brought to justice. The appeals from these vulnerable communities is that foremost, we must put the spotlight on the abuses and suffering they confront. As world attention has turned to the tragedy in Ukraine, the desperate situation of the Afghan population, the most vulnerable, has not lessened. They rightfully note that we should not be able to, that they rightfully note that we should be able to do more than one difficult thing at a time. And I can say that my office and the bureaus and offices that I work with are committed to doing our utmost to ensure that their voices are injected into U.S. policymaking and international deliberations. We also share their assessment and recommendations with the United Nations and international partners and allies. A fundamental threat in atrocity prevention is rendering it visible, naming it, identifying the risk factors and warning signs, and then taking action on the basis of an informed assessment. On the diplomatic front, we and our allies have pressed the Taliban on the situation of ethnic and religious minorities and human rights. I'm keenly aware that many will dismiss this as a futile exercise, but it is important for the Taliban to understand that they cannot achieve their goals of normalized relations with the international community when half of the population and Afghanistan's most vulnerable are pushed out of the equation. All of the communities that I speak to demand greater accountability, including investigations, evidence gathering, and documentation. Given that many members of the international community no longer have a presence in Afghanistan, it is all the more important to ensure that the Office of the UN Special Rapporteur for Afghanistan, Richard Bennett, is well-funded, supported, and staffed. We also need to work closely with the UNAMA office, particularly its field offices. We need to encourage the OIC and regional actors who maintain a presence in Afghanistan to make sure that they and their offices have a human rights address. And finally, we need to support human rights actors, local actors, through funding, cybersecurity training, and other tools to give them a fighting chance to carry out their work under incredibly challenging circumstances. My office is committed to supporting all of these priorities. The road ahead will not be easy, but Afghans, particularly the most vulnerable, do not have the recourse to leave. They have no choice but to walk the perilous path. Our option is not whether or not to support them, but to lean in and to commit to the ways that we can support them and to stand resolutely shoulder to shoulder with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Rena, for your powerful remarks. And thank you to everyone for joining us for this important conversation. As Rena noted, today we're gathered for the purpose of rendering what is all too invisible, visible, the plight of ethnic and religious minorities in Afghanistan. We do so because as an institution, we understand all too closely and intimately the potentially deadly consequences of failing to do so. The United States Holocaust Memorial Museum teaches that the Holocaust was preventable, and the museum's Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide seeks to do for communities at risk of genocide today what was not done for the Jews of Europe in the 1930s and 40s. We do so by striving to put a spotlight on communities at risk and elevate their voices in calling for preventive and protective measures and for justice and accountability. Our work focuses on genocide and related crimes against humanity, crimes often marked by their large scale and group targeted nature. Today, we're discussing a situation that has been alarming for decades, where groups have been targeted on the basis of their identity. Afghanistan is and has been at high risk of mass killing for several years. Even before the return of the Taliban in August 2021, our early warning project, which forecasts the risk of mass killing, has ranked Afghanistan as amongst the three highest risk countries in our last five assessments, and is ranked in the top 10 countries at risk since 2015. We're especially alarmed now. The Hazara, a religious and ethnic minority, have faced persecution and violence in the past, and there have been recent brutal attacks against members of the group, including school children. In August 2021, the museum issued a warning that the Hazara face a risk of crimes against humanity and genocide, and that other ethnic and religious minorities in Afghanistan face a precarious future. We noted that the group faced targeted violence when the Taliban was last in power, and since its emergence in 2015, ISIS Khorasan province, ISIS-K, has also attacked the community and stated that its goal is to exterminate the Shia, including the Hazara. The Taliban have attacked women's rights and have summarily executed former officials. Afghanistan has been plunged into a humanitarian crisis, which can exacerbate the risks against already vulnerable communities. Members of civil society face significant risks to their safety, and many have fled. It's especially harrowing that in this time of great atrocity risk, the people who are doing the important work of documenting crimes and sharing information with those around the world are now being harassed, sidelined, or silenced. We should not be caught off guard by the current crisis in Afghanistan. Afghanistan has established risk factors for genocide and other mass atrocities. Those include ongoing armed conflict, major political instability, potential perpetrators with exclusionary ideology, both the Taliban and ISIS-K, and those who've committed mass killings in the past have not been held properly accountable, leaving few restraints on future mass atrocities. When conflict or mass atrocities are ongoing, sometimes the policy response seems to focus on the immediate humanitarian needs of civilians at risk. While this is understandable, the U.S. government and others have tools at its disposal that will help plan for and develop effective responses to deter mass atrocity risks farther along the horizon. In Afghanistan today, we're already seeing the failures of world leaders to put those tools into action. We're seeing a rising tide of efforts to stem mass atrocities in Ukraine, the use of an array of sanctions, provision of refugee status, advancing accountability through support for those who are conducting documentation efforts, international support for domestic legal cases, and even proposed legislation to bolster accountability for perpetrators on U.S. soil. This growing effort to promote accountability for crimes in Ukraine should, as our USIP colleagues, Belkis Amadi, Kate Bateman, and Scott Warden have noted, it should also apply to Afghanistan. It is not too late to prevent atrocities in Afghanistan. Those at risk within the country today deserve the full support of the U.S. government and others to respond to current atrocity crimes and prevent those in the future. It is my deep honor to now introduce our panelists. We are joined today by Farhunda Akpari. Dr. Akpari is a postdoctoral fellow at the Gender, Peace, and Security Center at Monash University. She completed her PhD in diplomatic studies at the Australian National University. Her research focuses on diplomatic engagements with extreme non-state actors in peace settlements, looking at the case of the Taliban in Afghanistan and the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia as actors of diplomacy. She's worked at the Department of Political Affairs in the United Nations headquarters in New York, the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, and Afghanistan's Independent Directorate of Local Governance in Kabul. She's also used her research to advocate for human rights, especially the rights of women and girls and vulnerable ethnic groups in Afghanistan. Shukriya Delawar is a peace and security expert, human rights advocate, and a gender specialist. As coordinator of the Prevention and Protection Working Group, a coalition of 250 human rights, religious, humanitarian, anti-genocide, and peace organizations, she advocates for the prevention of mass atrocities and genocide. PPWG was instrumental in passing the Elie Wiesel Genocide and Atrocity Prevention Act and the Global Fragility Act, two groundbreaking legislative initiatives that advance global peacebuilding and conflict prevention. Prior to her tenure at FCNL, Shukriya worked in the development sector on women's empowerment and in the defense sector as a political analyst and cultural advisor, testifying before Congress as a subject matter expert in multiple briefings. She's led several fact-finding missions to Afghanistan and represented the Center for International Policy as a senior fellow for 7 years. She also consults with the Afghanistan Peace Campaign to push for peace and reconciliation while advocating for protection of human rights. She serves as an advisor to the Thought Partnerships, an organization dedicated to advancing nonviolent, just, and inclusive societies. Lauren Bailey is a senior program officer on atrocity prevention at USIP. She leads a program that explores the intersections between atrocity prevention and cross-cutting criminal justice reform issues, including countering violent extremism, combating corruption and transnational organized crime, and promoting women, peace, and security. In partnership with the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, she works to develop a comprehensive curriculum on atrocity prevention for practitioners in the justice and security sector. Lauren joined USIP after 10 years at the Public International Law and Policy Group, PILPG, where she served most recently as vice president and senior counsel. During her time with PILPG, she worked extensively on accountability and transitional justice in conflict and post-conflict settings, including, says Sudan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Kosovo. Her expertise includes human rights documentation, design of responsive transitional justice mechanism, women's participation in peace and transitional justice processes, justice sector accountability, and strategic litigation as a tool to promote accountability. She's led field experience in Libya, Kosovo, South Sudan, and Tanzania. Prior to that work, she worked with the U.S. State Agency for International Development and the Brookings Institution. We have a truly phenomenal group of women to talk about this incredibly critical topic today. I'm going to turn to our panelists for a few rounds of prepared questions before turning to the audience. You can take part in today's discussion by asking a question using the chat function located just below the video player on the USIP event page. We ask that you please include your name and specify from where you are joining us today. So with that, I'm now going to turn to our panelists. First question, as we try to understand what the mass atrocity risks are in Afghanistan, is which groups in Afghanistan are especially vulnerable to mass atrocities today? And who would the key perpetrators be? And if you can talk a little bit about their motivations, that would be helpful as well. I'm going to turn first to Farhunda.
Thank you very much, Naomi, for the question. And also just want to take the opportunity to thank the organizers and also the audience participating today, this very critical and important event. Turning to your question, unfortunately, there are many categories and degrees of vulnerabilities in Afghanistan about who is vulnerable, specifically since the Taliban came to power in the last 10 months. As you mentioned in your remarks, and then as Rina mentioned in hers, there are a different kind of situation unfolding, women and girls for their gender, the Hindu Sikh community are being targeted or have been targeted for their religion, and the people of Panjshir for their political resistance, and then the Hazaras who have been targeted very systematically for their religious and ethnic identity. There are also many types of crimes occurring or happening in Afghanistan and that have been amounted to war crimes. But here for tonight's discussion on mass atrocities, I think it's really the situation that the Hazara communities are facing, a very distinctive patterns and nature of crime that are being targeted to the community. And then what has happened to the community throughout history, at least in the modern history of Afghanistan, there have been different waves of persecution, both by state and non-state actors or armed actors, that show us that the community has been facing a process of genocide. It may have, there may have been an event of genocide, especially in the 1890s under the Emir Abdurrahman's reign, where it is believed and also recorded that about 62% of the Hazara population were wiped out, and they were taken as slaves and treated as an infidel under the decree that he issued. And it has happened since then. We as community tracing at different times that there has been a particular kind of discrimination, and it was more on that ethnic and religious identity. Coming back to the Taliban, during the Taliban regime, the kind of narrative that the Taliban used in the 1990s against the Hazara community really resembled what Amir Abdurrahman Khan used during his time of persecution of the Hazaras, such as the Hazaras are infidels and they need to be wiped out of Afghanistan. We do know the massacre of Mazar Sharif in August 1998. My family have been victim of that particular massacre. We do know about the mass graves in Bamyan in Yakaulang that the UN found as soon as the U.S. and the coalition forces entered Afghanistan, that they were booted months before. We do know about the cultural genocide of the Hazaras, destroying 2,000-year-old Bamiyan statues that sort of symbolized Hazara identity and Hazara's presence in Afghanistan. And the economic embargo of Hazarajat is not known as much about that. During the Taliban regime, there was this embargo in central Afghanistan where the Hazaras are residing that prevented the distribution of or the flow of humanitarian aid and access in those regions. But then post-2001, the Hazaras cooperated with their heart and soul in the democratization process because the community felt that this process is lifting them out of being a second-class citizen, and at least their rights were being recognized under the 2004 constitution. The Hazaras were participating in elections in large numbers. Women were leading their civil society organizations across Afghanistan, or in the security sectors, in also other leading other platforms feeding that progressive sort of mode in Afghanistan. But these really activities became part of Hazara's vulnerability today, because it became a lot more justifiable to extremist organizations, including the Taliban, that the Hazaras have gained from these opportunities. They have lifted themselves out of their historical roles as being the subordinate, the second-class citizen, and therefore they need to be pushed back and they need to pay back for what they have gained. On your point about motivation, as Rina mentioned in her remarks about the typology of crimes that have been taking place against the community, it's the mother giving birth to their infant child, it's the school girl, it's also the school boy, it's the sportsman in the gym. The attack has been on every part of social life of the Hazaras. And what this indicates that that there is a kind of wiping of the community or destruction of the community in part, if it's not in whole, and the attack on youth, on infants, also tells us about the motivation behind these attacks are signaling to the community that you do not have a future in this country. And this is very concerning to the Hazaras. As mentioned, there has been persecutions. There are patterns of persecution, but when youth are being particularly targeted, as young as infant, I think we have been trying to understand the mind behind the strategist of this extremist organization. Who are behind it? That what do they want to tell us about it? Why they could blow a mosque or this or that, but why an infant, why the infants or why the hospitals or why schools, young children, and this automatically I think tell us and tell the world that it's also about our future, and about the who are the perpetrators. I think this is something that we don't know much. There has been very less talk and less information about it. Partly it's a failure of previous Afghan government, and also unfortunately the international community who were present with foot on the ground in Afghanistan, and the pattern of attacks on the Hazaras that have been happening more targetedly, at least post 2001, started from 2011 onwards, that they did not identify or bring one single perpetrator to light or to justice to tell us that who is behind these attacks. I can say perpetrators are being politicized. There are the government used to blame the Taliban used to blame the government, and now they are blaming the resistance groups who are opposing the Taliban, but nobody really brings out the evidence that who is killing the Hazaras. It's very easy to blame everything on ISIS, but the history of Hazaras or at least Hazara persecution shows that it goes beyond the existence of ISIS. There are different groups come and goes in the political landscape or security landscape of Afghanistan, but one thing remains solid, and that is that the Hazara remains vulnerable and they do remain a target. And this is where I think it is time, it is late, but it is time for international community to really look into what is behind the scene, especially in terms of perpetrator, and I look forward to discussion and hear more about from the experts on the topic to learn and also to understand and also raise awareness to responsible authorities internationally on what we can do next. Thank you, Naomi.
Thank you, Farhinda, for that. And thank you just for providing also the historical context of the systemic discrimination that has been experienced by the Hazara community for decades, but also the intentional destruction of cultural institutions and artifacts, the physical attacks. Nock's team has written about how just in April alone, within 10 days, there were 5 attacks on the Hazara community. And to just be very clear for those who are listening, as Farhana mentioned, that includes attacks on maternity hospitals, attacks on schools, attacks on mosques, places where people come together to celebrate as a community or to give life or receive medical care. But as you know, one of the big challenges really is in identifying the perpetrators. But there have been multiple opportunities for the international community to invest in documentation, to invest in gathering that type of information, as our USIP colleagues have talked about. There has been, since 2020, an open ICC investigation. There have been, at various times, different efforts to try to identify who perpetrators are in document, but many of the reports have never been made public. And there is definitely a big gap there when it comes to the accountability efforts, but also really understanding, as you noted, in more granular detail, the nature of the threats and how then best to tackle and address them. Shukriya, your perspective on this.
Thank you. Let me just start with thanking both USIP and the US Holocaust Memorial Museum for this very, I would say, urgent discussion and timely discussion. I also want to thank my colleague Farhana for her courage to speak on this issue. It's very important. Going back to your question, who's suffering these atrocities? So obviously the minorities, particularly the Hazara community, as Farhana just articulated, the Sikhs, the Ismailis, Panjshiris, Ahmadis, women and girls. The perpetrators are often the Taliban, ISIS-K, but as Farhana said earlier, there are many perpetrators. If you look at the historical context, this conflict has shifted. There's been so many power shifts, and in every turn, one or the other group has been targeted. And in this particular note, I want to say the ICC investigation was shut down by the Trump administration. There was evidence collected of atrocity crimes in Afghanistan. That this is where we have to take, the U.S. government has to take some self-responsibility. It's really hard to hold other perpetrators accountable when we're not willing to hold ourselves accountable as well. And then I want to also talk about motivations. The motivations for these groups, obviously, it's power, it's ideology. There's a lot of revenge killings. Every time a government shifts or a new government comes in, there's no rule of law, there's no accountability. As Farhana mentioned earlier, no single perpetrator has been held to account in Afghanistan by the international community. Clearly, this is a culture of impunity, that we're neglecting Afghans. And 38 million people continue to suffer. And other than that, it's also, I want to point some nuance. There's also men suffering under the Taliban rule. You know, that if your beard is not long enough, you know, then you might end up in jail as well, or get a nice beating. And I don't want to say it's everyone, but I do want to say that we often hear, and very rightfully so, because women and girls and minorities suffer acutely in Afghanistan. But it's also a lot of men that are brave enough to put their girls to school, to allow the woman to work. They deal with stigma, they deal with revenge killings, they deal with all kinds of things. Currently, it's a very, very, I would say, gray area. It's hard to point to one thing, but it is very important to start these investigations. And this is where the UN is critical. The UN Human Rights Council is critical to start the investigations, to document. We are seeing that in Ukraine. It can be done at high speed if we have the will. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Shukriya. And also just for highlighting the reality that when we talk about vulnerable communities, there are so many communities and subsets of them that are at risk and that are not necessarily receiving the level of attention that they should, including men, and within that, specific communities of men that face a heightened risk. In terms of this question of how atrocity risks might evolve over time and the types of indicators that we should be looking for and watching for, especially with an eye for developing contingency plans, thinking about the types of tools and strategies that can be used to help mitigate future risks, and better understanding how we should respond, what are some of the indicators that we should be keeping in mind and the possible evolution that can occur? I'm just going to start, maybe Shukriya, with you to answer that question.
Sure. It's very important to understand that atrocities don't happen overnight. They require planning, preparation, and execution before any atrocity crime unfolds. As we know, many risk factors surface. So particularly in Afghanistan, there are concerning factors. Some we have already, both Rina Amir and Farhonda alluded to, but there's continued political instability, humanitarian crisis, widespread human rights violations for both men and women. The women and girls suffer more acutely. Violence, disappearances, extrajudicial killings, detentions, attacks on schools, mosques, seizures of property, and then censorship of media, acute poverty, culture of impunity, widespread hate speech and revenge killings. And there's more, sadly. That's a short list. And if the situation continues as is, there's sure to be greater risk of atrocities for both minorities and women and religious minorities, as well as ethnic minorities.
And if I can just ask Shakria, just a follow-up on that, is there particular regions or parts of the country that you think are especially important or require more focus and attention?
I mean, I think if you just go back to what Farhonda said, if you start with the Hazaras or the Panjshiris, I mean, just this is we're talking right now, right? Historically, there's been, but also the Sikhs. It's just the list that we need to be able to track the evidence. And I think this is where the UN Human Rights Council, the new rapporteur, comes in. His office is very, Richard Barnett, his office is very critical. It should be resourced. It should be well-staffed. And they should be able to gather all of this evidence. There's a lot of Afghans in the diaspora community that are very active. They're actually sharing this information. I'm happy to make those connections if anybody wants to reach out to help collect that evidence. Thanks.
Thank you for that. Farhonda, your perspective on this.
I think I agree with what Shukriya just said. I'm happy to hear from others.
In comparison to other cases where we have seen mass atrocities unfold, what lessons are there that we can learn and draw from?
Sure. Thanks, Naomi. And thanks to my fellow panelists. It's great to be on this panel with you and to be learning from you as we go along. In this discussion, as Naomi mentioned, I'm going to try to provide a bit of a comparative perspective. What can we learn from other situations? And as I'm listening to Shukriya outline the risks as they exist, you see the challenge, I think, that is really presented by this situation, which is when there is a sort of high level of imminent risk regularly, what are we really looking for to try to understand how risk is evolving and how we should be responding to evolving risk? And what I would say overall, and I think this holds true of state practice as well, is we're looking for changes in the way that perpetrators are approaching their victims, in the way that rhetoric is being used, and in the way that restrictions are being imposed upon the population. And so just some initial thoughts on this. When we see the sort of civilian targeting patterns that are being used for many of the attacks, I think Farhonda is absolutely right that when you're targeting children, infants, women, you're sending a message about the continued presence of a community and country. That could easily shift to broaden in scope or scale. And if that were to happen, we would want to be mindful of that and see that as an evolving risk within the context of Afghanistan. When we do see this happen in other contexts, I would look at sort of Boko Haram in Nigeria. And as they became bigger and had more of a political message to send, they went from sort of low scale attacks to mass kidnappings of girls, forced marriage, larger attacks intended to really send messages to the civilian population. So you're looking for changes in how a perpetrator is approaching their strategy. Similarly, changes in rhetoric. We're hearing a lot of sort of existential calls, exclusionary calls that certain populations don't belong in Afghanistan. Those will calls for violence at some point if we were to see a risk escalation, and we should be watching for that. What this rhetoric does, this sort of derogatory rhetoric, the dehumanizing rhetoric, is create that enabling environment for violence. And then at that point, perpetrators are simply looking for an opportunity to carry out violence on a broader scale. I would also just mention one more, which is the restriction on rights. And this is where we're seeing, I think, lately in the near term, a lot of restrictions on women, and particularly with the hijab decree I would reference, which is sending a continued message that women no longer belong in Afghan society, that they shouldn't be seen or visible. But what is potentially really problematic about the decree is it's also requiring that families enforce the hijab requirement on their female family members. And so likely we're about to see an increase in violence against women that will not be reported because women will not have an outlet to report violence against them. And the state is asking citizens to impose and enforce the rules that it's establishing, the de facto state. And so I would say just overall, from a comparative perspective, in this sort of intense, sort of high intensity, imminent risk environment, we're looking for changes in the way that perpetrators are acting, the way that perpetrators are speaking, and then potentially also shocks that might provide them with an opportunity to pursue mass violence. And it's important, just as a final point, to remember that the use of mass atrocities is never an end in itself. It's typically a tactic to achieving a political goal. So where the potential perpetrator sees an opportunity to further their political goal, that mass violence can come about, and that can be an opportunity to use it more robustly.
Thank you for that. Incredibly helpful just to remind us of how rapidly evolving a situation can be and the different motivations that may heighten the likelihood that potential perpetrators will resort to the commission of mass atrocities to achieve different goals and ends. I'm wondering, just as we think about that, one of the, I think, key aims of this conversation is to really remind people watching, remind policymakers that there are preventive and protective tools available that can and should be used. There's been some discussion already about the importance of documentation and accountability in that vein. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit from your experience about what are the capabilities, responsibilities, and practical next steps for the US government to take that can help to monitor and then prevent mass atrocities. If we were to really kind of take seriously this idea that there should be an atrocity prevention strategy that is applied in the context of Afghanistan, as we have seen called for with the passage of the Elie Wiesel Act, as we've seen kind of embraced through the articulation of now three different presidents who kind of articulated that atrocity prevention is a core national security priority for the United States, what would that actually look like, Lauren?
Sure. Thanks, Naomi. And I think I'll look at this through sort of four priorities that the U.S. should be taking as they think about this. And they've been mentioned already by each of my colleagues on the panel and by you as well. And the priority, I would say, is documentation, is strengthening the ability of human rights to get information out of Afghanistan on the human rights situation. So strengthening human rights monitoring and documentation efforts. And this is particularly critical in the face of the dissolution of the Independent Human Rights Commission. This will help us fully understand the scope and scale of the risks that we're facing. As Farkhanda mentioned, there's a lot of confusion over who the perpetrators are, and that's pretty normal in this kind of scenario. Victims are not, in the moments in which they're being victimized, it's not always clear who's committing the crime, who the perpetrator is, and who they represent. And so establishing that record is going to be really important to trying to understand the situation and to respond to it appropriately. And so the kind of support that could be provided is in support to independent journalism and then support to local documentation initiatives. And these are ongoing in Afghanistan. So it would be support to ongoing local Afghan initiatives. These initiatives are going to be the ones that have credibility with vulnerable communities. They're going to be the ones who are already collecting and sharing information, but could use the support in sort of professionalizing the work that they do, thinking about how to systematically collect information, how to make sure they're securing informed consent from people who they're speaking with, and that they're thinking sort of in a forward-leaning manner about how their information is going to be used. Is it going to be used to establish an evidentiary record? Is it going to be passed on to advocacy organizations to support reporting? Will it support processes of memorialization? And these kinds of initiatives are ongoing in a number of different contexts, including in Syria, South Sudan, and in a more nascent way, in Ukraine. They're conducted in situations where both the documenters and victims face fairly considerable risks in collecting information. And that is part of what needs to be supported, is thinking through how to help them be secure in the information that they're collecting, and how to ensure that they're able to operate in a way that sort of maximizes both their security and the security of victims. These initiatives require secure storage platforms. So a few of the things that they could use: secure storage platforms, training on personal security, access to some of the various applications that have been developed to document atrocities, like the Eyewitness to Atrocities app, or apps that allow them to hide information if they happen to be questioned or detained. All of these are being used in ongoing conflict documentation settings, and they're largely supported by the State Department's Bureau of Human Rights, Democracy, and Labor. And so DRL should and can be leading on these initiatives to provide support to locally led documentation initiatives. In addition, I want to note a new development that's happened around the Ukraine conflict, which is the Conflict Observatory, which is supported by the State Department's Bureau of Conflict and Stabilization Operations, and is a consortium of organizations who are collecting, verifying, and analyzing evidence that is publicly available, so open source information. And they are doing so too in the interest of furthering accountability for Russian atrocities. The contexts are slightly different in the sense that Ukraine has more internet penetration, and therefore there's more of this online information available. But this could set a really important precedent for documentation efforts, particularly those led by the U.S. government. And those documentation efforts in the past have fed into U.S. atrocities determinations, which could also come in as a helpful step within this case as well. So just, and I'll be brief, I realize I'm speaking for a while now, a couple of other comparative perspectives here. Support to the UN Special Rapporteur. The appointment of Richard Bennett is a really important step in this process, but he is understaffed and underfunded for the mandate that's been presented to him. And that's going to present some challenges in really maximizing the utility of this position. And this is where our U.S. government colleagues should be thinking about how to support him in this process. And I might point to the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar as an example of how this can be done well. Tom Andrews is a former Maine congressman who has been highly critical of the Burmese government, the junta at the moment, and of the international community for the ways in which they're fueling mass atrocities that are occurring within Myanmar at the moment. And so the practices that he's learned and developed, I think, could be helpful to apply to this situation. A couple of significant differences is part of the Special Rapporteur Bennett's mandate is to both support civil society, but also to support the government. When the coup happened in Burma, that sort of government support mandate came off of Tom Andrews' plate. So he was able to be very critical of the government because he wasn't trying to bridge that gap between supporting the de facto authorities in fulfilling their human rights obligations and then supporting civil society members and expressing their human rights concerns to the government. In addition, as a former congressman, he knows how to advocate to the U.S. audience, which I think is a way in which our colleagues in the government can support Special Rapporteur Bennett to make sure that his findings are disseminated effectively across different fora. And I would say too, and maybe we could continue this conversation, and I can allow my colleagues to jump in as well, talking about the potential of establishing a formal UN-backed investigative mechanism to give more credibility to the information collected, to centralize it, to allow it to be stored, and to potentially inject the language of mass atrocities into the conversation, I think is a priority we should think of. There are three of those that exist internationally now, one for Syria, one for Myanmar, and one for crimes committed by Daesh, which is working in Iraq right now, but is not geographically limited. It can operate with host state consent and Security Council approval in any situation in which Daesh crimes are occurring. And that's an important option to consider. And then finally, working towards breaking the cycle of impunity. And perhaps I can pause here and we can discuss this further, but thinking through not only what the ICC can provide to Afghan victims, but also universal jurisdiction cases where we are engaging domestic courts, particularly in Europe, in seeking to hold perpetrators accountable for atrocities that have occurred in Afghanistan.
Thank you, Lauren, so much for that incredibly comprehensive overview, especially in regards to the components around documentation that are very practical and actionable in this particular instance, and where really it's quite stark the contrast between what has not been happening in Afghanistan but has been done in other cases. So how do we ensure that we actually see equity in the international response for the people of Afghanistan, as Shukriya said, with 38 million people whose lives, many of whom are imperiled at this particular moment. One thing that I think is important, just as you talk about the value of collecting, analyzing, and preserving information potentially for future prosecutions, is what you said at the outset, that this is also important just from the perspective of fact-finding, of sharing with the public, especially the Afghan people, the human rights reports, the acknowledgement of the crimes that have been committed, the use of actual calling crimes by their names, if these are war crimes, crimes against humanity, if they're genocide, actually invoking the language. I think our USIP colleagues have been incredibly forceful in saying that when we talk about certain members, including actors within the Taliban government who have committed war crimes and crimes against humanity, we should be acknowledging that. We tend to default to the use of the term terrorism. We see that also in the Iraq context. We also see individuals being prosecuted for crimes that could constitute genocide, but they're being charged with counterterrorism charges. There's a whole host of elements that when we talk about documentation, we can pursue, first and foremost, helping the Afghan people better have visibility on the crimes that have occurred, those who've been held responsible, and Farhanda, as you mentioned yourself, your own family has been the victims of these crimes, helping people locate and know where their loved ones are, what happened to them, ensuring that people are held accountable for those horrific crimes is so critically important. Shukriya, I wanted to turn to you for your thoughts on what type of preventive and protective options are available, and also just your assessment of how the international community has been doing.
Thank you, Naomi. Just want to say that I think Lauren set the stage really well with this question, so I won't duplicate what she said, but I maybe want to just emphasize a few points. The U.S., as you mentioned as well, has an obligation under the LUSL Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act, which states that it's in the U.S. core national security interest to prevent atrocities. So the Atrocity Early Warning Task Force is quite active. Actually, PPWG, the coalition I coordinate, it engages with them regularly and quarterly on different conflicts. And we've had conversations on Afghanistan as well. And I want to say, to start with, both the LUSL Genocide and Atrocities Prevention Act and the Global Fragility Act, it's calling for integration and a holistic U.S. government approach, a coordinated U.S. government approach to prevent atrocities around the world. We're seeing that approach in real time on Ukraine. We are not seeing it on other conflicts. We're especially not seeing it in Afghanistan, which is why the population is suffering acutely. Obviously, the U.S. can support, and this has been mentioned, I'll repeat it, the U.N. Special Rapporteur's Office, in evidence gathering and documentation, but also the Atrocity Early Warning Task Force can do an updated country assessment on Afghanistan and look at these indicators and think about programming and other options, soft power options we have. And then I also say you can't look at, so it's like, how did we get to where we are, right? So there's some lessons learned that the U.S. government also needs to pay attention to. There's a few things we did in the last 20 years, a few big things that really led us to where we are. So one of the first lessons is, if you want to prioritize prevention, atrocity prevention, don't empower known perpetrators and atrocity crimes that have committed atrocity crimes and warlords to official government posts. It was a critical misstep on USG's part, which didn't help any credibility among Afghans with the two governments. The second lesson is prioritize peace over military solutions. That was not done in Afghanistan. We missed very critical markers. And if there was peace, all the other great work that was done would have been sustainable. So peace and reconciliation, the focus came at the very last end of that war, and therefore we missed a lot of great moments where peace could have happened and we didn't have to be in today's situation. So prevention, prioritizing that prevention. The third lesson is practice what we preach, right? Because if we are now calling out Russia on war crimes, But then we've had our own war crimes and conflicts like Iraq and Afghanistan that there's been no accountability for. We can go to Abu Ghraib and many other examples. But the truth is, if the U.S. government wants to be held wants to hold others to a moral standard, to a human rights standard, we also have to uphold it in practice. And then the fourth and last thing, I think it's also a lesson, I think, for all advocates working on this right now, and I'm glad we have a huge audience watching this today. I love what's happening on Ukraine in terms of accountability for atrocity crimes. I want to see that in every other conflict where vulnerable people are suffering. That includes Afghanistan and many other parts of the world. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Shukran. I wanted to turn now for kind of to your perspective and kind of Afghan priorities for prevention and protection.
Thank you, Naomi. I think I will build on what my colleagues on the panel said tonight, but highlighting really and also prioritizing that there is a need for recognition, for acknowledgement, and for documentation. Coming back to the Hazara community, it has been at least 120 years under our record that the community are facing mass atrocities, including ethnic cleansing, persecution, and even a genocide. What has passed is past. Last 20 years, missed opportunities, lessons to be learned. But I think what we really missed was to understand that capabilities that were in our domain to understand that how the situation is evolving, going back to your earlier question, and how the vulnerabilities are being highlighted and being maximized. Today, under the Taliban regime or in Afghanistan that is ruled by the Taliban government and within a very unfortunate and uncertain future, but recognizing that the Hazara community are facing targeted killings, targeted attacks, and acknowledging that there are systematic discriminatory policies in the country. We do know, fortunately, about half of the population, about women and girls, who are being sidelined, even wiped, veiled in very brutal ways, and they also get highlighted internationally. But again, that acknowledgement about the community, communities in the country that are becoming a lot more vulnerable under the Taliban regime, I think this is something that we need to look a lot more, and that take us to that. Even, I mean, I understand practically what is possible and what is not possible for policymakers or for the international community in their engagement in Afghanistan. But in the limited engagement that we have, I think there are still possibilities of documenting these crimes that take place, and understanding the nature of it, and taking away politics out of it. I mean, they are being very politicized. My point about that, it took 120 years for the Hazara persecution and the vulnerabilities of Hazaras to be recognized at the level that it is being today, shows that the international community really missed something. A lot happened in that country to the community, but if they did not have the language and the tongue to speak to the international community, but the international community as well lacked the ability and also the capability and also the willingness to recognize those. So being a member of the community, for us, recognition means a lot. It may not solve our problem, it may not secure our mosques and our school, but it does give us the security that our vulnerability is being recognized, it's being acknowledged. And with that, I think documenting the crimes that take place against the community, and then the other steps that comes practically, how we could secure it. I share an example with you. It was during my communication with our colleagues that organized the event, as the Mazar massacre or the Mazar killings were happening. There were suicide attacks on the Hazara route targeting transportation that were taking. They're very poor and vulnerable members of the community, I mean, living in a particular suburb and taking the particular route, and they were targeted. And my family member went to the hospital to give blood, but they were not able to record anything. They were not able to take a single photo. As much as plus 30 people were killed and their bodies were brought to the hospital. There was many more wounded people, and there was people giving blood, but they were not allowed to take a single photo from that tragic incident, because the Taliban denied that. That shows that documentation by local people comes with a risk. And here comes the roles and responsibilities of international communities and responsible bodies and instruments that allows such organizations to be able to operate in Afghanistan, and with a particular focus on the Hazara community, because we can't, the community is resilient, they're doing their best, but they need support in the context of today's Afghanistan, with the Taliban muting and the media, the civil society and advocates. I think if looking at this context, it become very clear what to prioritize internationally. We are also thinking practically, we're not asking what is not possible, but as simple as something as recognition, acknowledge, and documentation. I think these are the very first steps that we need to take, and then hopefully it could set us to the right direction that we could prevent mass atrocities. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. You know, in listening to you, it really kind of drives home that the failure to really center Afghan voices in the decades of international policy response on Afghanistan has in part contributed to the situation that we're in right now. And as you have so clearly stated, one of the most basic asks that you and your community and others are asking for is a recognition of the value and import of that voice, but also of what is happening to you. In listening to all three of your responses, I can't help but ask this question of, you know, is there not a heightened duty of care also in this situation on the international community in terms of the efforts that the U.S. government and other governments undertake to try to prevent mass atrocities, given the decades of involvement, engagement, and heightened promises and expectations that were made to the Afghan people? And then a very dramatic change in the situation within the country. I wanted to turn to some of the questions from the audience and remind our viewers that you can put questions into the bottom of the event page for the panelists. Allison Edel is picking up on this point that a few of you have touched on what is your assessment of the U.S. government's engagement in terms of an overarching strategy and a whole of government approach? This seems particularly important given the complexity of the crisis. Shukriya, you've talked about how there seems to be an absence of a whole government approach at this point. Is there something that you'd like to add to that assessment?
I think post U.S. troop withdrawal, there's been a little bit of silence, I have to say. And I don't want to throw my USG colleagues under the bus, because I do work with them very closely on multiple conflicts, and I do see that there is foundation being built to actually address atrocity crimes, and there's more documentation. There's more information being shared with civil society. So I think working level staff, functionaries, I definitely want to, you know, give them a shout out, actually. I think they're doing a great job in working under severe and difficult circumstances, and they do reach out. But then when we look at leadership, I think that's where the issue remains. There's we prioritize geopolitical will over the fact that we want to prevent atrocities around the world. And I think not just in Afghanistan, but in any conflict, if we continue that way, we're just playing lip service to the Aliwazal Genocide Atrocities Prevention Act. If you want to make never again a reality, and that's what this community has been asking for a long time, you really have to do that by practice. And we are not seeing that practice by leadership. We're not seeing that prioritization. We can just do a very easy Google search and you look at what we are spending in war and defense and hard power. And then what are we spending really on peace and prevention? Not even like it doesn't equate to pennies when you do that comparison, right? So we have big, big issues. And I think the most important thing that could probably come out of this conversation first is the highlighting the needs of atrocity prevention in Afghanistan, but also the broader picture of where are we when it comes to prioritizing prevention around the world. We're always on the late side. The atrocity happened. Now let's see what we can do. And this is just not ever going to get fixed if we really don't get serious about the way we're doing. So I hope that the leadership is listening to this, and I hope that they take this seriously, because especially for American taxpayers, we end up paying a lot more in the aftermath of atrocities, because a lot more is needed, and then you have very limited tools. But if you look at those early warning signs on different conflicts, and I'll highlight the early warning project by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum that comes out every year. There's a lot of indicators that for many countries we could work on and prevent, but we don't, because we don't put our appropriators are not putting the amount of funding needed actually to deal with the demand around the world for atrocity prevention. And so I think we have to get a little honest and in our self-reflection on how much we're prioritizing never again. Thanks, I'll stop there.
Thank you so much for that. I feel like all too often the focus of the conversation is on making genocide determinations. And once you've hit the point where you're making genocide determination, it means that you have failed to prevent. And we have lost untold number of lives, and societies have been forever changed. Lauren, is there anything that you'd like to add to Allison's question?
So I would agree with Shukriya overall. I think the thing that I would add, and what makes Afghanistan unique among U.S. involvement in atrocity situations, is our own involvement. And I think you've referred to it, Naomi, as the heightened duty of care. And I think that is the way that our colleagues within the U.S. government are looking at it, but articulating that in a sort of policy sense has been slow to develop and has been sort of awkward, because there's a reckoning that happens with the way that the evacuations went in August, with the ways in which we didn't see fairly obvious signs that the Taliban was going to take over the country. And so in many ways, this is a sort of unprecedented situation. I think there's ways in which we should respond, and that's what we've been discussing this morning. But our colleagues are struggling with how that sort of the being torn between that response and sort of understanding our own involvement in driving the risk in this instance.
Thanks so much for that. It is unprecedented, yet there are some examples in the context of Iraq that we could draw from, where we saw, unfortunately, the targeting of religious and ethnic minorities. Over 900,000 people had to flee from Nineveh in the north. ISIS committed genocide there. And that is an area where we have seen a really robust investment in documentation, as you said, for example. We did see actually a form of a military intervention to a degree to open up pathways for Yazidis to flee, but where there has been continued struggling on what an atrocity prevention strategy should look like. So it's an area where we have to continue to really focus and bring attention. I think the point also around what do you do in the aftermath of this large focus on evacuations, we have to remember the vast majority of people at risk and who are vulnerable will never have the chance to leave Afghanistan. And in a way, when we talk about religious and ethnic minorities, for that to happen means that we would see a future of Afghanistan without the diversity, without these communities being able to live in their own homes. So it is a, you know, I think that Shukriya said at the beginning of the conversation, this is such a critical and urgent conversation. This is one where we have to be able to kind of walk and chew gum at the same time, because the urgency of the needs on the ground are so great. Shukriya, you have had your hand up.
Yeah, I just wanted to, thank you. I just wanted to, emphasize what Lauren and yourself just said, but you know, like we also can't do a trust view prevention in a silo, right? So looking at U.S. responsibility in the way we withdrew, we did not have a peace accord in place. We did not have UN peacemakers in place before we withdrew, hence the colossal disaster. We also, when we were negotiating the U.S.-Taliban agreement, we did not have the Afghan government involved. We did not have women's representation. We did not have minority representation. This is where that self-reflection is important. If we were saying for 20 years, we believe in democracy, we believe in human rights, we believe in women's rights, and then we turn around and we do something like that, how can any Afghan take us seriously? Honestly, if I was sitting in Afghanistan, one of the 38 million people, I'd look at the US, I'll be like, okay, Cold War, you abandoned this afterwards. And then after 20 years of promises and much good work done by many people, I don't want to say that that wasn't done, but not looking at the sustainability of that and withdrawing in the manner in which we did. And then, of course, there were the, at the 11th hour, we tried to evacuate as many people as we could, but we can't evacuate 38 million people. You still have to solve the problem. And I think here the U.S. bears the greatest responsibility with all its NATO allies and all the coalition allies to work with the U.N. to solve the problem for the long run. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Turning to you, Farkhunda, before we take another question.
Thank you. Maybe not directly to the question, but in reflections to what colleagues have said, what U.S. can do, international community can do in this current situation. Look, coming to the today's topic, looking at the Hazara community, we're talking about a very small suburb of two to three million people in Dasht-e-Barchi, west of Kabul. And as now we are speaking, anything is possible there. Another targeted killing that could kill plus 200 children. But what have been done so far? We have been speaking about this in the positive light in the last 2 years at least, but not before. But what has been done? It's practically very something that is possible for that practically could be protected. A small area in geographically that the community has been targeted. There has been reports by UNAMA. There has been 35 plus attacks on the community in recent years, and the typology of attack that was mentioned earlier in today's talk happened in that particular geography, which is very small, very limited, but with very dense population, and nobody has been able to take a step in, be it the state and now another regime or the international community, to protect this community. And today, as we speak, we could go off and finish this this webinar, and then another attack happened, another 200 children or other members of the Hazara community die. So I think we really need to boil down to very practical steps about protection of the community, even if it's just Dasht-e-Barchi, even if it's that in just that particular location in Kabul. If it's hard for you to go to Bamyan or Dikundu or other places, Dasht-e-Barchi is a few kilometers away from embassies and the presidential palace and the airport. And this is where the community is being targeted by the so-called ISIS, the Taliban, or other groups. And it doesn't extend more than a few kilometers. And we haven't been able to do that. And this is where I think we need to, the community is craving and desperate to see a very small step that international community, including the U.S., could take to show that they're being recognized and they're not forgotten, especially after what the community contributed in the last 20 years. And this is, it's not just the number of people being killed, it's also that the morale of the people, the morale of the community that is being really destroyed because they thought that they could change things, they could sacrifice, they could and they could change it, but now it's not happening. So I just want to emphasize that the community is very desperate to see, and this is very important for the morality of it, if it's not very much on being practical on the protection of the entire community. Thanks.
Thank you for that. Just that notion of feeling abandoned as your community faces a really serious existential threat to your survival is, if there's a more clarion call out there for action, I'm not sure what it could be. It's just so clear. I wanted to pick up on a theme that you touched on, and I think each of the panelists have talked about, Warren, especially in your conversation and documentation. We have a question from Molly, Virginia. One clear contrast between the situation in Ukraine and Afghanistan is that the Ukraine government is welcoming investigations into war crimes committed by their opponent, whereas the Taliban are seeking to avoid investigations into atrocities within their country. What is the track record of atrocity prevention in countries where the government are perpetrators or impose investigations, like China and Burma? Are there any good tools in those cases? And maybe I'll just add a second, which is, you did mention also the existence of apps that can help in the documentation effort. There is also an effort by the Taliban and others to try to restrict the access to the use of these apps, questions about how to secure electronic data. How can Afghans safely collect and preserve documents as well? Maybe I'll start, Lauren, with you, and if others have comments, we'll turn to you.
Sure, thank you. And it's a really great question. And I think Molly's pulling out an important point, which is part of why the process of accountability in Ukraine has been so smooth and so immediate, is that the Ukrainian officials are both able to prosecute war crimes on their own and are interested in prosecuting the crimes, both committed by Russians, but also by Ukrainian military forces. And that's obviously not the case in Afghanistan, and it's typically not the case in many of the places where documentation missions are required. I think one of the reasons the documentation has been so successful in the case of Myanmar is because we're documenting primarily within the refugee camps for the Rohingya in Bangladesh. And so we're able, the access is easier. The documentation can happen in a safer way. That said, there are ways of doing documentation that can happen within this sort of really secure conflict setting. And what happens in those instances is there's a reliance on technology when it's available, but I think there's also a recognition that the tech can be either shut down, either due to sort of low capacity in country, or due to sort of a focus from state actors on what kind of technology is being used. And so frequently what happens in documentation missions is that there's deference to those who are operating on the ground. What is the best way to collect information? Is it through photos? Is it through victim or witness statements where you're conducting interviews? And then how do you tailor them to ensure that you're not particularly visible, that you're not putting a person you're speaking with at risk, and that you are not doing something that's going to raise the attention of local authorities? That's an ongoing conversation, and it's an imperfect one, because just as documenters are adapting and evolving their practices, so are state authorities and so are perpetrators. And so if documentation is too frequently on the radar, state authorities, de facto leaders, interested actors are going to be on the lookout for documenters and will try to actively cut off access to vulnerable populations. And that's happened in a number of contexts. So I would say it's a combination of both thinking through the options that are available, but really working with local communities and local documenters to try to take advantage of both of their knowledge of the security situation. I also want to highlight something that's critically important for documentation in insecure settings, which is human rights defender protections. There are going to be times when documenters are going to be at imminent risk. And in that instance, we as the international community have a duty to protect them, because just as they are carrying out the important work of documentation, protecting them sends a message to state authorities too of the perspectives that the international community takes on human rights matters and human rights documentation. And so that needs to be part of our agenda as well. And again, the State Department, the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labor has very good practices on that that will need to be tailored to the Afghanistan context.
Thank you so much for that, Lauren. Yes, please.
I think with the current situation on the ground, we need to come with innovative ways of engagement and support on the ground. I think grassroots organizations are playing a very critical role right now. If we look at how the humanitarian situation is being handled, knowing that there are big international organizations, but there are very many small grassroots organizations operating in the country still, who are not able to evacuate, or they still operated. They believed in the cause, and they are underground, but they are making their ways in doing their work. I'm in touch with several of them, but I think is supporting grassroots organization in the communities, not just in Kabul or urban areas, but in rural areas, in vulnerable communities, will be really, really critical to be able to understand, document the situation in those provinces. Let me tell you, in my province, in Daikunji, there is one journalist. It has about over or less or more 1 million population, but there's one journalist existing in the country that we know, and he struggles with finding food or making the end for himself and his family. So I think we need to come up with very innovative and creative approaches on how we are going to engage in Afghanistan and really boil it down to engaging with people in local communities, local organizations, looking at their track record and also supporting them. They will be the one that could give you the most realistic picture of what is happening in the country, be it for women and girls, be it for the Hazara community or other vulnerable community or others. I think this is very critical. If we, like usual or like the tradition, rely on big organizations, which I have my respect for them, but it also comes to their limitation, the politicization of the topic, and also the way in which they report, which could affect for us to understand what is fact on the ground. And then particularly on the Hazara community, the civil society has almost collapsed in Afghanistan, but there are still many more left in the country. I mean, the civil society leaders from the Hazara community, which I'm aware of, they have not been able to evacuate because they were working in the grassroots and they were not in the list for any embassies or part of any big networks in Kabul to be able to evacuate, which was really shaped and influenced by those political networks. They were still working, they were still operating. They have no support. They don't have, at the end of the day, they don't have any food on their table, but they're still very dedicated to the cause. I think another aspect for international community to be able to understand or find or those people is to engage with diasporas. There's a large numbers of Afghan diasporas in every country, and I would highlight and recommend here engage with as diverse group as you can, not who you have been dealt with in the past 20, 30 years of the Afghan conflict, but with everyone else to be able to really grasp and find your way out into the country, to the grassroots. And I really think that the meaningful change always comes from the grassroots organizations, and they need your support and your help.
I think we all wholeheartedly agree with everything that you just said there. I am struck by one thing that we haven't touched on, which is the fact that we need innovation today to look at the crimes that are occurring today and the crimes that will occur in the future. But there was an immense amount of work done at great personal risk over the last 20 plus years to document the crimes that occurred, crimes perpetrated by a number of different perpetrators, including crimes perpetrated by the NATO ISAF forces. And much of that documentation remains in the country. And there needs to be a really serious effort to try to find a way to ensure that that information is preserved. Those are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people's personal experiences that have been entrusted into those who took their narratives or documents and other forms of evidence that can and should be used. So there is a real urgent need to find creative solutions to make sure that all of that effort that was undertaken is not lost, and that it forms the record and the narrative of the country's history and the history of all of these individuals and communities that we've been talking about. Shukriya, I wanted to ask if you had anything that you wanted to add to this question prior to turning to the end.
Thanks. I actually just really want to thank you, Naomi, for pointing out that the ICC have collected all of this, and a lot of Afghans have put their lives at risk, and I hope that that will be preserved and that that should be the new human rights repertoire's priority. I also want to thank Bailey, Lauren Bailey, for all the great points you laid out. I do want to take the conversation now to long-term solutions. I don't want to put this burden on Afghans. Clearly, they're under difficult circumstances. We should not be putting this burden of evidence collection on Afghans at this critical stage. It really needs to be a UN independent investigation effort, and we need to be supporting that. The second thing is, we cannot not solve the Afghan political crisis and humanitarian crisis and expect atrocities to go away. So we really need to focus. The USG needs to support any UN effort into peace building, into Truth and Reconciliation Commission that should be established. It's really hard to solve what's happening today in Afghanistan without getting some of these leaders to talk to each other and forgive the past and reset. The Taliban need to be held, U.S. needs to hold the Taliban to the agreement, to their end of the agreement, inclusive government, women's rights protected, minorities protected, ethnic religious minorities as well. And then I also want to say that often when we talk about women, and as Afghan-American woman, this has been a painful thing to watch for 20 years. So I want to point it out. We're always looking at the veil, the unveiling, the veiling. I'm really tired of it. Women are suffering from economic issues. The rule of law was not established the way women needed the protection in the last 20 years. It's much worse now. We're paying for those repercussions. They have economic needs. They have security needs. They have education needs. And I want the focus now on those needs. And I'm tired of this veil unveil. That should be their right. They should be able to decide if they want a veil, they don't want a veil, but this should not be the American or Western media focus, because that is just gaslighting the issue. And I for one, just not going to hear it anymore. Thank you.
Thank you very much for pointedly outlining where the focus needs to be and to reminding people not to be distracted. I wanted to just, in closing, ask each of you, if you don't mind, we had one last question from Kelly Burkhouse on what can individuals do to push for a real solution? So maybe just in each of your closing remarks, if you could just reflect on what you would like to see from individuals and how they can stand in solidarity with the Afghan people, I would be grateful for that in your concluding remarks. I'll start, Shukriya, with you.
It's tough. It's a heavy issue, and you can clearly see my emotions in it. I just want to start with gratitude and thank yous to both USIP and to you, Naomi, and to USHMM in particular as a partner of BBWG. You know, I think we have to look at individually our own biases, and we really, if we want to prioritize prevention, if we want to do atrocity prevention, if we want to really, you know, not give just sort of not use never again as a political tool, but really as never again, we are against genocide. I think it really requires self-reflection, self-correction, holistic approaches to different conflicts. And in Afghanistan conflict, obviously you want to reach out to the advocates that know this the best, the ones on the ground, the peace builders, the ones that have been active for 20 years, the ones that can actually really help the peace and reconciliation and reintegration process of Afghan society as a whole. Really have to, I would say, emphasize on the big picture solution where we're working on the immediate, which is prevent harm to mass communities like the Hazara community, to just prevent that. Don't wait for another episode of an atrocity event. That's it. I'll stop there. Thank you very much. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Shukriya. Lauren.
Sure. I'll jump in to say that I think when we think about individually what we can do to prevent further atrocities in Afghanistan, it's really supporting our Afghan colleagues and really understanding what this process means to them too, what their interests are, what the risks are, and what they would recommend that we do. I think a lot of times these conversations get pulled into broader political discussions, they get pulled into our own sort of regional interests, and we lose at the center of this the people who are at very serious risk. And so as an individual, how best to support this process is to do some of what we did today. And I will say thank you to Farkanda, to Shukriya and Naomi. I've learned a lot from all of you today. And so I would say keep talking to our Afghan friends and keep learning about the risks and what they're looking for from their future so we can design prevention initiatives that are supportive of achieving that goal.
Thank you so much for that, Lauren. And finally, Farkunda.
I think knowing that what Afghanistan is today individually, it's important to know that what is happening today in Afghanistan, the outcome, the result, is not what an average Afghan would desire, be it anybody across the country. Today, we have girls not being able to go to school. There's an atrocity of an ethnic group, and there is silencing of journalists and civil society organization. As a country, I think we are at the bottom of the ladder of every indicator that tells about our development. And an average Afghan does not want that. An average Afghan has done everything they can do to be able to lift their life out of this cycle of conflict and misery that has been imposed to us both nationally and internationally by different actors. And your sympathy, your compassion individually makes a lot of difference. And the uncertainty that every Afghan lives today, be it inside the country or in diaspora, it's very difficult. I mean, it's heartbreaking that what we are going through as people of that geography. And please do everything you can in whatever category that interests you, be it girls' education, be it women's rights, be it democracy or human rights or prevention of atrocity crimes against minority groups or a vulnerable ethnic group like the Hazaras, to change something in Afghanistan, because our destiny in that geography is not only weaved by ourselves, but it is historically being given to others in the world to decide for us. I'll end with that. And
thank you so much for that. And maybe just in closing, I'll just end with where we started, which is there's absolutely nothing inevitable about what is happening. You know, the Holocaust was preventable. These crimes are preventable. If we can find the will to identify the solutions, and if we can commit for the long term to helping alongside our Afghan partners, friends, colleagues, to affect the type of change that we've been talking about in this conversation, we can hopefully create an outcome and improve the future for so many people who at this particular point, as we've talked about for the last hour and a half, do not know tomorrow if they're going to be the victim of an attack at a house of worship. Do not know if their children are going to be killed when they go to school. Do not know if their medical care will be available to them. Do not know if they'll have jobs, food, and so many people who are at immense risks are doing the type of important human rights documentation, fact-finding, and life-sustaining efforts that that our panelists have been talking about today. It's been a real privilege to be able to be joined by the three of you for this conversation, and immense gratitude to USIP, who's been doing remarkable work on Afghanistan for a long time. Thank you for the opportunity to partner, and thank you to our USIP and US Holocaust Memorial Museum colleagues who helped to make today's conversation possible. I hope that it helps to compel renewed focus, attention, and that it helps to, in a small way, remind our Afghan colleagues and friends that they are not abandoned, and many of us will continue to work to try to ensure that there is a better future. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.